about it. And so he tried to raise it, and he very graciously replied, although there was an ungracious failure to reply to my issue of national importance, in fact, global importance. But presumably he will summon the courage one day to reply. Right, having said that, welcome all, welcome particularly to Erba. Those of you who don't know, it's Bernard Agalas, the CEO for Life, it seems. He's been around a long time, and he's very competent. In fact, Erba performs extremely well with limited resources. And just to give you a quick background for those of you who don't know, on the eve of the end of the fifth term of Parliament, we had a bill before us, which included changes that Erba had negotiated with National Treasury and the Minister on to make its role more effective. As it happens, the committee itself was complaining about the inability of Erba to do little more, as we saw it, metaphorically speaking, a slap on the wrist to errant auditors and the like. Okay? So they said to us, yeah, we agree with you. We also want to hasten the process of finalizing our disciplinary processes, but the law is very cumbersome, the process set out in law. So the committee and Erba, I'm putting it in a crude nutshell, of course, agreed on the changes, and so did the NCOP side, except that the bill came to us very late. So we badgered National Treasury. There were various changes, both at the level of officials and ministers, as you know. And so, you know, the process got held up, and when it came to Parliament, we absolutely, on the NA side, found that we were being unreasonable to expect the NCOP. We negotiated the highest level, and the then chair of the NCOP said, no. And she was right. I'm not going to allow myself to be bullied by the minister or treasury, or indeed the standing committee on finance. We don't want to get involved in internal politics here. Suffice to say, we regretted deeply that the bill could not be finished. We dealt only with the immediate aspect of the post bank, if I recall. It was a general bill, and we left all other provisions except one that the Reserve Bank insisted on, because the deadline for the global multilateral organization was August 2019, and they said even if Parliament reconvenes in June, the prospect of meeting that were dismal, and after negotiation, finally, reluctantly, our committee on the NA side agreed to give it to the NCOP. Only dealt with those two aspects, if I recall. We asked that the bill in our report be brought back immediately Parliament reconvened. I did, in fact, speak to the DDG dealing with legislation to find out where that is, but, in fact, I didn't pursue the conversation fully. Not that, but we're supposed to meet to look at legislation for this year, but I didn't pursue further with him for a variety of reasons, the matter. But Bernard seems to know a bit more than I do about where that bill is. But he will also tell us a bit about what it is that they would like. I see the program's been changed. It was meant to be two items. Remember, I even sent them to you. Briefing on the annual report and then legislative changes. Yeah. But here the draft agenda says briefing only. It doesn't say about what. Item 3. That's incorrect, right? As agreed. Yeah. The item 3 should be amended to read 3A. 1 is the review of the annual report of Erba. B is legislative changes necessary to make Erba more effective. That's the agenda, right? Then the next issue is apologies. Dikilidi Mashlangu, I'll send a note as a bereavement in the family. Zolani Mkiva has said that he's unavailable to come. And now we've got a third apology from Mama Rakhali. Okay? So there we are in Jadu. We are depleted here. If we went to the vote, what would happen to us? You and I will walk out and they won't have a quorum. So we can get away. All right. Okay. Watching this voting. Okay. Welcome all. Particularly Erba. I don't know you, my colleague. I know you, but I've forgotten your name. You can speak for himself. Yeah. Oh, yes, you can speak English, right? Yeah, okay. Please, just mention to the meeting.
It's Maurice Furiche. I am the financial manager / CFO of the RBA.
Member to come, and they're having a board meeting this morning, so we said, okay, we understand. Okay, over to you, Bernard.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Good morning, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity. Chair, the board, it's not a board meeting, but it is a board committee meeting, so most of the board members are there. Chair, because we've got a bit of time this morning, we have divided the agenda into five sections. First of all, I'll give feedback on the annual report as you requested and just highlight some of the important areas. And then, because it's our first briefing to the select committee, we thought we'd also give some background to the RBA's mandate. It's all in the annual report, but explain the role of the auditors and explain the role of the audit regulator. Then, as the chairman requested, we will talk briefly about the Auditing Profession Act amendments, which have progressed quite quickly in the last few months. Fourthly, I'll give you an update on recent activities of the RBA. Again, all covered in the annual report, but some of those I'd like to highlight. In the last part, I just want to update the committee also on some high-profile cases. We've reported on some of them in Parliament before, and I just wanted to give you an update on the current status. We have in the past been asked by Parliament and specifically by the Standing Committee on Finance to also keep the committee posted on progress with KPMG specifically and the issues that happened about 2 years ago. And I thought I'd also give the committee an update on where we are with our monitoring of KPMG. So if I can start with the first part then and just give you some highlights of the annual report. You'll see that the first page of the annual report covers what we believe were important areas that we focus on and that we wanted to bring to the attention of the public. The first is our initiatives to restore confidence in the profession. There's been a lot of negative perceptions around the auditing profession in the last 2 to 3 years. And it had become quite critical that the RBA, together with the profession, starts to rebuild the trust in the profession. And as I will explain later, the role of the auditor and the role of the RBA is to create the confidence in our financial markets, which will stimulate investment and create employment. And therefore, it is important that we cannot let things go ahead the way it is, and we had to come up with various initiatives to restore the confidence in the profession. Secondly, we've issued a part of the Restoring Confidence projects have been to issue certain guidance documents, not only to auditors but also to audit committees, because we believe that there are a lot of role players that must contribute to restoring this confidence. It's not only the auditing profession, but those other role players in the financial reporting chain, and therefore we have also focused on audit committees, and I'll talk about that later. But the guidance that we've issued to audit committee specifically is audit quality indicators. We've also asked firms to start giving us transparency reports. It's very important that the public has more information on the audit firms themselves, and therefore we haven't made it compulsory yet, but we are moving towards a point where we will request this as compulsory documents. We've also had good progress on mandatory audit firm rotation. Some of my slides later on will cover the status of mandatory audit firm rotation, the number of firms that have rotated, and I'll give you some statistics on that. And then we've issued our inspections report that covers the results of the inspections that we carry out. We've issued a revised code of ethics, again in response to the negative perceptions out there and the fact that one of the root causes we believe that things have gone wrong in the auditing profession is because there's been a lack of ethics. And therefore, we've looked at our code of ethics and revised that to make it stronger so that auditors can comply better and have more guidance to comply with the code of ethics. On our education and transformation, we have registered a lot more candidates for our audit development program. That is the program to qualify new auditors and also, of course, strengthen that process so that we can ensure that whoever comes onto our register has the required competencies. We were one of the first organizations to finish an investigation into the Gupta-linked entities. The audit of Linkware Trading specifically had been completed, and the auditor sanction has been passed on the auditor of Linkware Trading specifically. And then under in respect of governance, we've mentioned that we're proud that we have had our ninth year of a clean audit in a row. We've issued our fifth integrated report, although it's not required. And on the international committees, we serve on the International Forum of Independent Audit Regulators, where we've been reappointed to the board of IFIAR and also as the chair of the audit committee. If I may then go on to the significant feature summary, which you'll find in your report. The first one is in relation to the number of registered auditors. And you'll note that since 2016, there has been a small drop in the number of auditors from 4,300 to about 4,000, that the only auditors in our register. And we believe that some of these some of the reasons for the decrease has been because of the current negative perceptions around the auditing profession. And hopefully some of our initiatives will again attract auditors back to the profession. But for now, we're sitting at the end of the current period, we're sitting with 4,000 auditors on our register. So a slow decrease in the audit, in the number of auditors, but at least we're still over 4,000. On the audit development program, as I explained, we have changed the way to qualify as an auditor. So it's not purely a technical exam that you write. That is still set by the institute. And after those that write the technical exam at the institute, we also require them to go through a program where they obtain practical training. And the RBA is directly involved in that training to ensure that auditors develop the competence that we require from them. Since auditing is a public function and we have to protect the public, the first step is to ensure that auditors have the required competencies to do so. And we've given you the increase in the numbers there over the last few years. We started in 2016. There were a few hiccups in the beginning because it was a brand new program. Even globally, we're one of the few regulators that have implemented this program, but we are now seeing that there's been quite an increase in the number of registrations. These are the new young auditors coming onto our register, and that we eventually register as full auditors with the RBA. The next one is the training contracts. The numbers there of the training contracts that are signed with the RBA is in the region of 3,000. The only reason that the late 2019 is slightly lower is because of a timing difference. We have noted that after the year end, more training contracts were registered, so it's really just because of late registration of the contracts that the number looks slightly different. You'll see an increase next year, or the rest of the contracts would come into the following period. But otherwise, number of training contracts still in the region of 3,000 per annum. A very important statistic to the RBA and an important statistic to the committee should be the report that we receive on reportable irregularities. Reportable irregularities are irregularities discovered by the auditor and reported to the RBA. The auditor has confidentiality requirements, so they cannot report anything they find in an audit to any organization unless it's in specific circumstances, for example, when it comes to money laundering, when it comes to terrorism. There are different reporting requirements, but otherwise auditors have to report any irregularities or alleged irregularities to the RBA, and we report it to the relevant body, say for example SARS, the JSE, and in some instances the police. And you'll see that the number of reportable irregularities that we receive a year, we divide them into those that we receive a first report, but then we also receive a second report, and the second report will either say that the irregularity didn't exist, or it is continuing, or it had been resolved. And as you can see, the number of reports that we receive a year is about 1,000, which is pleasing, not for the fact, not because there's misconduct, but because it means that at least auditors are reporting on these irregularities. So those numbers are, the important column there is the total number received, and they remain in the region of 1,000. You'll also see that one of the concerns that we've had about the report of irregularities is once they report it to us and we report it to other organizations, we don't know what happens at the client on which these report of irregularities had been reported. And in the past, some auditors resigned or some auditors were fired when they reported these irregularities. And one of the amendments in our Act now says that you cannot fire an auditor just because they reported on some misconduct by the finance department. So that's a very welcome change, one of the changes. The next item is on our investigations and disciplinary matters, and when we look at the performance information of the RBA, you'll see that the one KPI that we didn't meet was on investigations. And while I'll explain it a little bit more in detail later on, it is because in the last 2 or 3 years we have had many more investigations coming out that's in the public domain. These investigations had been extremely complex, and instead of spending our capacity on, say, 100 investigations, we've had to focus on the high-level, complex investigations. And again, as I'll report later, we have very, very limited staff, and we have to focus our capacity on those high-profile public interest investigations. And therefore, that's the one target that we did not meet, but those investigations that we carried out, we did properly, and we received the outcome that we wanted. And similar to our disciplinary hearings, you'll see that there are not that many a year, and that is because of the current process that we subjected to in terms of our current act. One of the big amendments in the Auditing Profession Act is to simplify that process so that we can carry out these disciplinary hearings much quicker, much more efficiently, and not go through the legal process that we are currently obliged to follow in terms of our current legislation. So that's also a very welcome change to our Auditing Profession Act. Then the number of inspections performed. We do firm inspections and file inspections, which means that we look at whether there's quality at the firm as a whole, and then we also look at individual files of companies to see whether there's any deficiencies on those specific or individual audits. And you'll also note that the number of firm and file inspections have decreased, and that is because we have focused our attention not on performing more inspections, but rather performing deeper inspections because of the issues that we believe exist in the profession. We have delved down a lot deeper into the firms, and therefore the numbers have decreased, and similarly we've spent our capacity on looking at files in a lot more detail. So instead of spending, say, a week on a file, we now spend 3 to 4 weeks on a file, but ensure that we do a proper inspection and not just meet a number of inspections target. We also perform our inspections following a risk-based approach. So we have a business intelligence department that surveys the environment and the audit firms, their clients, what's happening in the country. And we identify where the high risks are. We focus our capacity and attention on those high-risk audits. Chair, I don't know. That's the first part. So I don't know if I stop and take questions or go through the...
They're not familiar, nobody here is apart from me.
All right, so
give an overview. Yeah, I would say, look, usually we don't like more than 45 minutes as a whole,
okay,
because we want to engage. But we should, I think, even deal with your legislative amendments. We propose we're doing it, it's integrated to your report.
It is.
So 45 maximum an hour.
Okay. Thank you, Jay. The next part is. On governance, but it's still the under our annual report. Our board is appointed by the Minister of Finance, and the current board's term expired last year in around about May, and the Minister has the authority to extend the board's term. Currently, the Act requires that the board members serve for 2 years, and they can only serve a maximum of 2 terms, so a maximum of 4 years. The Minister did extend that 4 years last year by another year, and that extension ends in May this year. So I believe that the process to appoint new board members is underway. We've gone through our process, submitted the names, recommendations to the Minister, and it's ultimately the Minister's decision on who to appoint, but that will probably happen before the end of May. Currently we have a board of 6 members. The maximum is 10, the minimum is 6. And the board then also takes care of the subcommittees like the audit committee, the HR committee, etc., consisting of board members. On our statutory committees, I've added it to the slides because I think it's important that in terms of our independence, sorry, let me just go back to the board. There's one point I wanted to make that's also in our amendments. Currently, South Africa is one of the few countries where we have an independent board, meaning that our board does not consist of auditors that we regulate. So you don't have the the people that we regulate on the governance structure. Currently, our Act says that not more than 40% can be auditors. So they are in the minimum, but it's still 40% of auditors. And when we refer to auditors, we mean auditors in public practice. We don't mean auditors that have retired or that have the experience, because we do need people with experience in auditing to serve on our board, because they deal with highly technical matters. But at the moment, the Act says 40%. The changes to our Act now says that there can be no auditors, practicing auditors, on the board. No registered auditors. So you can be retired, or you could be an auditor registered with us but not in practice, because once you have influence over what the regulator does, then it impacts directly on our own independence. That's important for the board, and that's important for the changes that we have asked. On our statutory committees, the statutory committees support the RBA. We're a small organization. We have about 90 staff members, and we are supported by five statutory committees that's established in terms of the Act. There's one for education, for standards, for ethics, inspections, investigations, and for disciplinary hearings. Those committees, what we have done over the years is also to try and introduce more diversity on the committees, not only in respect of race, but also in respect of gender, because we have seen from the various business and audit failures how a lack of diversity can influence the outcome of decisions. And therefore, we also need a committee that's not doesn't only consist of auditors, but also consist of a diverse group of people, so that we can get the diverse inputs. Then the last bullet there is just the CEO recruitment process. I have been reappointed for getting the profession through this difficult period, specifically to restore confidence. That contract was for 2 years, and it ends on the 31st of March, and the board had embarked on a process to recruit a new CEO, and that is underway. On the financial statements, we've given you the highlights. You'll see that in our income there's a very slight increase, and my next slide will deal with the sources of income, which is very important. But at the moment you'll see that a very small organization with a very small budget, our annual income is 40 million. That's from government grant. Other income, 78 million, and then our expenses run into about 131 million. When we, because we have to deliver on our mandate, we normally plan for all the expenses, and if we do go into a deficit, we request from Treasury whether we can use our reserves to make good on our deficit, so that we don't have a deficit at the end of the period. And therefore, when we do get into a deficit, we have the authority to transfer money from our reserves. The next slide deals with our income sources. You'll see there that most of it comes, or some of it, about a third comes from government grants. The rest comes from our regulatory functions, licensing auditors, monitoring of the firms, registration fees, and training contract levies. And then we also levy a fee on auditors for the inspections that we perform. So when we perform an inspection, we charge auditors for the time that we spend there, but we do not base the charges on the time and the hours that we spend. Otherwise, there's a direct relationship between the RBA and the auditor, and that could impact on our independence. What we have therefore done is we ask auditors to declare all their assurance fees to the RBA annually, and depending on what those fees are, we will then levy a percentage of that assurance fees for our inspections. So that's our non-exchange transactions, giving us a total of about 116 million a year. Under our expenses, we have the big increase, you'll note, is in our disciplinary and investigation expenses. And the huge jump you'll see there, 172% for performing investigations and part of the disciplinary process, really linked directly to the current status of the profession at the moment. The fact that we've had to spend a lot more money on lawyers to defend to present our case to the independent disciplinary committee, because the auditors do have a strong legal team that backs them up when they present their case to the committee. And so we spend quite a bit of money on that. Very importantly, when I come to the amendments, you'll see that that process has now been simplified to the extent that we will also reduce the cost involved in running a disciplinary process. So again, a very welcome change. The committee expenses largely increased because of the days that the disciplinary committee have set. So the other committees continue to sit about four times a year, but the disciplinary committee has sat for a number of days. On one of the hearings, one of the big hearings alone, they have sat for several weeks, and it means that we have to pay not only our legal counsel, but we also have to pay our committee members a daily rate. Because they are lawyers and accountants, they do come at a very high cost. So those are the changes. The auditor's remuneration appears lower, and that's only because we have changed our internal auditors to National Treasury, and National Treasury doesn't charge us for the audit. And therefore, the audit fees for external and internal audit has decreased. Report of the Auditor General for 2019, and in fact for the last 9 years have been exactly the same, a clean audit report on our financial statements, on our other regulatory requirements, which consist of the predetermined objectives, as well as our compliance with laws and regulations, and of course on our internal controls. And when I say clean audit report, I mean there's been no modifications, there's been no emphasis on matter, it has been clean audit reports. And lastly, on our annual report, we have included the performance information. I won't go through these in detail. You'll also note that we've met all of our targets. It's not so easy to set targets for a regulator. We can't say that we're going to have 100 investigations next year because we don't know what's going to be reported to us as investigations. We don't know how many disciplinary hearings we'll have because we don't know how many cases will go to disciplinary. But we do have strategic measurable objectives that we agree with National Treasury, and amongst those you'll see, as I mentioned earlier, it was only the investigations that we did not meet, and that was because the board had requested that we focus on the high-profile cases so that we can at least address those auditors that we don't take action against, those auditors that shouldn't be exposed to perform public audits out there as quickly as possible. And this is when we say high-profile cases and public interest cases, we mean cases or audits where the public can lose money, lots of money, pensioners can lose money, and investors can lose money. So those are the huge financial public, with the huge financial interest and public interest, we try to fast-track those cases. And therefore, instead of doing, say, 20 small cases, we did 5 high-profile big cases. And we're happy with that as long as we do a thorough assessment of the investigation and the hearing. So that concludes part one, which deals with our annual financial statements. And I think, as the chairman said, it might be useful to then go straight into part two and just give you some background to the RBA's mandate, what our act requires from us, and what we've been doing. So under part two now, I'll move on to give a better description and explanation of the role of auditors and the role of the RBA, but I'll start off with our legislative mandate. So the RBA came into existence on 1 April 2006 in terms of the Auditing Profession Act of 2005, and we then moved from being the Public Accountants and Auditors Board, which existed since 1952, I think. Various reasons at the time for becoming the Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors. One of the main reasons was the international failures in audits and business, including the Enrons, for example, Arthur Andersen. And in South Africa, our Minister of Finance at the time said that we should overhaul the whole accounting and auditing profession because it seems like there are issues in both professions. Because of those audit failures, notably Arthur Andersen globally, the minister then decided not to focus on overhauling the accountancy profession, only the auditing profession. And therefore, they changed our Audit Act to become the Auditing Profession Act. And I mention that because later I'll talk about how we intend or how we propose that the accountancy profession should also be changed and legislated. But at the time in 2006, the focus was on the auditing profession. Our Act provides and gives us a mandate to do the following. We must protect the public by regulating audits performed by registered auditors. And it's very important because there's sometimes confusion in the market as to the difference between a regulator like the IRBA and a professional body like South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. An institute and a professional body exist to protect their members and to look after their members' interests. The RBA does not look after auditors. The RBA looks after the public interest. But it doesn't mean that we don't support auditors and that we are not. We are still required to be the custodian of the auditing profession. And therefore, our functions also include giving guidance to auditors, supporting auditors, assisting auditors to ensure that they deliver high-quality audits. So, first and foremost, our responsibility is to protect the public and to protect investors against auditors that do not perform high-quality audits. We have to issue internationally comparable ethics and auditing standards. So while in some countries the audit regulators are purely regulators, in South Africa the RBA also sets the standards for auditors. So we issue auditing standards and we issue a code of ethics for auditors. So just again to explain the difference between the Institute and the RBA, the easiest way to do it is to go back to the Chartered Accountant qualification. In South Africa we have about 50,000 Chartered Accountants. They're all members of the Institute. Of those 58,000 accountants, only about 4,500 are registered auditors. And they have to register with the RBA because auditing is not just a normal accountant. It's a public function. The public relies on the work of auditors and therefore they have to be regulated. So that is why we also have to ensure that the standards which they must comply with are internationally comparable and are of the highest standards. Something that we boasted many years in the past was that we were number one in the world for our auditing standards, ranked by the World Economic Forum for 7 years. That changed drastically in 2016, where we dropped quite a few places. But the reason that we could compete with international standards is because we have adopted the international standards on auditing and the international standards on accounting in 2005. So we set out the standards and issue the standards for auditors. We then have to, we also set the competency requirements for auditors, and that is what I referred to earlier in terms of the audit development program. We have to decide what competencies auditors must have before they can register with us, because, as I mentioned earlier, if we don't have competent auditors, we are not going to have high-quality audits, and we cannot protect the public unless we ensure that our auditors are completely competent. One of the projects that we're looking at the moment, of course, would include revisiting whether auditors are competent and whether our requirements that we set for auditors to perform high-quality audits are still sufficient, not only because the world has changed, but because clients have changed, and with the introduction of technology, the way that audits are performed have changed, and therefore the way that the RBA does our conducts our oversight over the auditing firms will change as well. But starts off by ensuring that our auditors are still fully competent to adapt and respond to the changing environment and the more complex environment. And then our Act allows us to investigate auditors and to take disciplinary action against auditors that have not complied with the standards. And we can take action against an auditor because they fail an inspection, or because somebody has reported an auditor to the RBA, or we can initiate an investigation internally when there's something in the public domain that concerns us and requires us to start taking action against an auditor. So that is really our legislative mandate in terms of the Auditing Profession Act. It's very straightforward. We have five functions. That's not all we do, but that is the main function that's driven by our performance objectives as well. The next slide, I wanted to just again stress the importance of obtaining political buy-in into the work of regulators, not just the audit regulator, but of all regulators. The importance that we do get support from government, from politicians, because what we do is not a, it's a public function. And because the objectives of government must be similar to that of regulators, and we believe that regulators must be supported by politicians and by government. So why it's important to have the political will for our mandate and the political support for our mandate is because we need to establish a clear framework of principles so that we can protect the public. We need to put in place a framework for the protection of the public, and what we do must eventually end up in protecting the public. And as I mentioned, that can't be different to what politicians and government wants to achieve. Auditors must be supported, though, and they must be legally required to comply with the standards. So unless there's legal backing for the auditing standards, auditors don't have to comply with the auditing standards or the code of ethics. But because there is legal backing, it's written into our Auditing Profession Act, it means that we can take action against auditors that don't comply from a legal perspective. And that is why we come to Parliament to support our legislation and to support any changes to our legislation, because we need the legal backing to carry out our mandate. It's important that the audit regulator's independence is always secured and respected. There cannot be any interference, not only from the profession, in the work of the audit regulator, but from any other parties. The independence of the audit regulator is very critical, because if the audit regulator can be influenced by any party, it could have an impact on the outcome of an investigation. And we have to carry out our investigation without fear or favor. We have to come to the right answer, whatever the answer is, and we cannot be subjected to any external influence, whether it's from the profession or from other parties. And therefore, again, it's important that we remain an independent body. And the RBA, I'm also proud to say, has been one of those bodies that have remained independent despite everything that has happened in our environment. And then the last one is, we said that we need support from legislative authorities. So if I can go back to the role of the auditor, and if I can explain it in simpler terms than the diagram that you see, auditors must perform quality audits. They cannot just perform a poor or shoddy audit. They have to perform high quality audits. When an auditor performs a high quality audit on financial statements, which are prepared by management, not by the auditor, it means that the audit opinion that's issued on those financial statements is reliable. And once the public, investors, pensioners, any users, banks, can rely on financial statements, it means they have confidence in the auditor's opinions. And if there's confidence on the auditor's opinions, it will result in confidence in our financial markets, which will attract investment and ultimately create employment, which is exactly what it says, stated in our Act. Ultimately, we are responsible for creating employment. So if you look at the opposite, if the auditor's opinions are no longer reliable because they've given the wrong opinion on a set of financial statements, clearly that is how we ended up in the situation that we are, where there has been a loss of confidence in auditors' opinions, and even in the regulator for not making sure that auditors perform high-quality audits. And for that reason, the RBA had to respond to the negative perceptions of the profession and levied against the RBA itself. One of those had been to strengthen our powers, because there was not much we could do to do things differently before, and I'll cover that again under the amendments to the Act. The role of the audit regulator then, if you add on to the confidence that's created by auditors providing opinions on a set of financial statements, and you add on to that the fact that an independent regulator comes in, inspects the audit work, and then takes action against an auditor for performing poor audits, then clearly the confidence that is added by having a regulator looking at the work of auditors must increase the confidence of users and of in our financial markets. Not all professions operate like the auditing profession, where you actually have 15 inspectors going out and inspecting the work of the professional people. And surely, if we do a proper job, then the public must have confidence that we will pick up whether there's poor audit quality, and of course, if we take action. If we don't take action, or sufficient action, then there will also not be confidence in the RBA. So the role of the audit regulator is then to make sure that high-quality audits are performed so that we can indirectly protect the public. Now, what are the key principles for effective regulation? This applies to, I suppose, any regulation, but more specifically for the RBA. I've already stressed the importance of the independence from the profession. We cannot be too involved with the profession that we regulate. But it doesn't mean that we're still not the custodian of the profession. We still remain the custodian. We cannot step away and be so independent that we have nothing to do with the profession. We still have to ensure that we work with the profession, not only to ensure high quality audits, but in the last 2 years to restore confidence in the profession. We have to work together. I've mentioned the difference between a regulator and professional bodies. If we want to be effective, our legislation must enable us to do so. If we go to an auditor and we want to do something and it's not in our legislation, we don't have a legal backing, then we won't be an effective regulator. And that's yet again why we ask the Parliament and Government to strengthen our audit legislation. We must have sufficient financial resources. And in the survey that National Treasury did last week, where they asked to rate various priorities, and where they asked whether there's anything else we'd like to see, we added onto our response that we'd like to see that government gives us the financial resources to perform our work, because without the financial resources, we cannot achieve our objectives and government's objectives. So to be a strong regulator, we need financial resources. We can't have too little money. We have to have sufficient money. We also need high quality and sufficient staff. Without the money, we can't appoint the number of staff that we need. And of course, we can't get good staff. We also need to have the best staff if we have to investigate auditors. And we have to have, we must have sufficient enforcement powers. And that goes hand in hand, of course, with issuing appropriate sanctions. One of the criticisms against the RBA has been that our sanctions were far too low. I think the chairman mentioned in the beginning, and just to illustrate how ridiculous they are at the moment, if an auditor, any particular misconduct only results in a 200,000 rand fine. Right, so that clearly would not deter the behavior that we don't want to see. And one of the changes then in our legislation is to ensure that the sanctions are sufficiently high. Now, the RBA's regulatory philosophy that you'd also have seen in our annual report is that we don't want to be a regulator that over-regulates auditors. It's not useful to us if we don't have capacity. It's not useful to auditors, and it's not useful to the public if there's too much regulation. But we come from an environment where there was under-regulation to the extent that we had self-regulation, where auditors regulated themselves. We can't have either. We can't have self-regulation. It doesn't work. And over-regulation is just costly and it's not practical. So ideally, we want to be in a situation where we want to have balanced regulation. And that is what we refer to as right-to-touch regulation. Right? It means that we mustn't over-regulate and we mustn't under-regulate. But when we're in situations that we are in at the moment, where we believe that there's a lot that needs to be done in the profession, then of course we will strengthen our regulation. But it's not ideally where we want to be. We want to have more balanced regulation. So if I can then, that's really just to sketch what we do. So if you put our annual report and your questions into context, at least you know what it is that the RBA does. If I can then move on to part three of the presentation, which is the amendments to the Auditing Profession Act. Before we go into the actual changes, we've tried to sketch the context for why we needed these changes. I think the committee would be aware of them. Excuse me. Firstly, it was because of the criticisms levied against the RBA itself, saying that investigations take too long, and that the sanctions are too lenient, and it could never deter the undesirable behavior that we want to actually manage and control. Obviously, also, the current environment had a huge impact on our decision to change the Act. Everybody's familiar with the high-profile scandals. There's a lot of corruption, not only in South Africa, but globally. Corruption in the private and the public sectors have increased, and therefore, it's more important that auditors perform the audit in a way that, not to discover corruption, but to at least develop procedures that might discover that there's corruption. There's been a lot of systemic failures, and when I say systemic failure, I mean that not every business failure is an audit failure. So there can be a business failure, but it doesn't mean that there's been an audit failure. If the auditor gave the right opinion on that company, then there's no audit failure. But what we've realized, especially with the recent high-profile cases, is that the problem doesn't start when the auditor gives the wrong opinion. The problem starts when the financial statements are not prepared properly, when there's corruption at the company, where there's fraud at the company, where there's not sufficient controls the financial directors don't pick up the errors and the problems, the audit committee doesn't pick up the errors, the boards don't pick up the errors, and therefore it's not just at the end when the auditors come in that there's a problem. There's a problem in the whole system. And that means that there's a problem in the whole governance chain, of which leads up to an audit report. Even on the King Committee, that's our governance code in South Africa, we are looking at how we can strengthen that code so that we could place more accountability on those other stakeholders. And I'll talk about that when I talk about comprehensive regulation. One of the major issues that we found in the profession is a lack of professional skepticism. And an auditor would not be, what we mean by that is that they don't ask the right questions, they don't ask sufficient questions to their clients, and that generally happens when the auditor is too close to their client. Then they start assuming things, and they don't do all the work they're supposed to do, they become too cozy with the client, and therefore it's not surprising that we introduce mandatory audit firm rotation to break up those cozy relationships. And again, I'll give you feedback on that a little bit later. Unethical behavior, market concentration is addressed not only in South Africa but globally, and in the UK specifically, their Competitions and Market Authority is looking at concentration. We are also concerned about market concentration. When we introduced mandatory audit firm rotation, we had three reasons for it. The first was to strengthen auditor independence. The second was to address the market concentration, forcing companies to rotate their audits and give opportunities to the next year firms. And thirdly was transformation. The public didn't and the profession didn't like all the reasons, and we ended up with doing it for independence reasons. But clearly, if auditors have to rotate every 10 years, it must open opportunities for others to come into the market and so address market concentration. Lack of transformation, again, diversity is important, and then fragmented regulation. At the moment, this whole system, the financial reporting system, is regulated by different regulators. And each has their own regulations, each has their own acts, and each has their own processes. And because of that fragmented regulation, it's very difficult to address the current problems that we find. But comprehensive regulation should address that. So the process for the current amendments started not in 2015. Those are different amendments. The first round of amendments was really to introduce the Audit Development Program. The second round of amendments was specifically to address the context that I've just painted for you. And the process so far has been Cabinet had approved the submission to Parliament of the Auditing Profession Amendment Bill at its meeting. Well, it's been a long process, and as the Chairman mentioned, it stopped because of the changes that happened. The version that was approved in December last year was the version that was included in the Financial Matters Amendment Bill. And in the last month or so, things have just moved very quickly to the point where the bill has now been certified by the Chief State Law Advisors, and it will now be introduced into National Assembly. And again, we as the RBA express our thanks to this Standing Committee on Finance, because it is not usual for a bill to be progressed this quickly. But I think with the Standing Committee on Finance realizing how important it was that these changes are brought about so that we can restore confidence in the profession and in financial statements, I think they supported what we tried to do and have progressed the bill as fast as they could, to the point where I believe that by February we will have a final outcome. What does the amendments in the bill specifically address? It includes, it gives the RBA stronger powers. It doesn't mean that we are looking to become powerful. It just means that we need powers to carry out our mandate. At the moment, we don't have the powers to demand that auditors provide us with the information. And in the Standing Committee on Finance, we were asked on a regular basis where the auditors cooperated with us. And the reason for that was that because they didn't have to. Right? Now, with the new powers to search, seize, and to subpoena, it means that we can actually now obtain the information that we need and don't go through a process where we have to wait for the information, which in the end halts our investigations and our disciplinary processes. The second change is to simplify the disciplinary processes. At the moment, our disciplinary process is, I believe, more strict than a high court process, because it is chaired by a senior counsel. It consists of senior counsel, lawyers, our disciplinary committee, and it follows the strict process of a court. And the way that we've changed in amendments now is that we've simplified it to say that if there's a hearing that has to take place, there's now a pool of members for the disciplinary committee, and a committee could actually convene with three people to hear a case. At the moment, there has to be a minimum of, say, six members of the disciplinary committee, which is reliant on their availability, because it's an external independent committee, on their availability. And if they are available, we have to make sure that the auditor's counsel is available and that our counsel is available. And therefore, the process becomes so cumbersome that it has delayed us. But the changes now will simplify that process so that we can get through these investigations much quicker. Lastly, our sanctions have been changed. It was linked to the to another act in the past, the Adjustment of Fines Act, which limited it to 200,000. It now says that the Minister of Finance can set a maximum fine for any transgressions by auditors. So there, at the moment, there is no limit to that. Just I have 5 minutes left, so I'll go through the next part of my presentation, which deals with recent activities, and all of this is also included in the annual report. Our strategy for the last 2 years and for the next 2 years remains on how we can restore confidence in the auditing profession. And we, as the RBA, independently have come up with about 40 initiatives. They're on the next slide. I won't go through those in detail. Those are initiatives. A lot of them have been implemented. A lot of them have been completed. But at the same time, the auditing profession, from their side, have also embarked on initiatives to restore confidence, because they've realized that they also have to get through this current negative perceptions of the profession. And our projects are very similar, and we've worked together on some of them, because it's not just one stakeholder's responsibility anymore. All of us have to take responsibility to restore confidence in this profession, and therefore on both sides, the profession side and the regulator, we started to with these projects, and I believe that if we can deliver on these projects, then we will restore confidence in our profession again, because what we have at the moment is not acceptable to anybody, least to us, and if these projects are successful, or when they are completed, we will have restored confidence in our profession. Those are the key themes there. I come back to comprehensive regulation, because we have gone to the Standing Committee on Finance to ask them to support our proposals to the Minister of Finance to ensure that there's not only oversight over auditors, but over accountants as well. And that's why I started off by saying that in 2006, we stopped the oversight of our accountants. We did not take any further action there. Now it's time that we again go back and revisit that decision and open up having oversight over accountants as well as auditors. So we have made a proposal to the Minister of Finance based on recommendations from the World Bank to extend the regulation of auditors to also include the regulation of accountants. If we have oversight over those other financial role players, and they know that action can be taken against them if they do something wrong, then we won't be in the situation at the moment where it's only the auditors that must be disciplined. But if those other role players also have some sanctions that can be levied against them because of non-compliance, then maybe we'll have if the whole system works, then it won't end up in problems in the audit. Mandatory audit firm rotation was an essential element to address the independence or the non-independence of auditors, where the public cannot have confidence in an audit firm if they've been associated with the same client for over 100 years. And even if they are independent, the perception could be that they're not independent. And once the public starts to perceive that there is no independence, then the confidence will disappear. And therefore, mandatory audit firm rotation has now addressed that. We're looking at the audit business models to see how the audits are conducted. We're looking at audit firm governance. One of the changes that we've seen specifically from KPMG to change their situation around was the appointment of non-executive directors, for example. And we've watched closely to see if that is a good idea, because in the past, the boards of the audit firms only consisted of the audit partners. Now they have non-executive members, which probably can't be a bad thing, because that's what we expect in companies. And so we are looking at how the audit firm governance has also changed, and looking into governance processes at the firms themselves that can be improved. Strengthening of audit committees is a very important aspect. Audit committees are there to look at the independence of auditors, to look at audit quality, they look at the appointment and the dismissal of auditors. The RBA should not have rules to necessitate that these things happen. The audit committee must do these things. And therefore, instead of criticizing the audit committees, we wanted to capacitate these audit committees. And we're working very closely with the audit committee forum so that we can share with them what we think they should be doing to help them to perform their function effectively. First thing we did was the audit quality indicators that I referred to earlier. We have to look at the training, skills, and competencies of auditors. I mentioned earlier that maybe the competencies required a few years ago must have changed, because we're operating in a very different environment. And again, as I mentioned, with more corruption, the expectation from the public is that the auditors must perform more work in certain areas, and we as a regulator have to look at our competence requirements for auditors. We've looked at the audit product. The auditing standards are being revised. The RBA serves on the international committees that's looking at these standards. We have not only input into it, we chair some of those committees, because it's that important to us that the standards are strengthened. And then, of course, the amendments to our Auditing Profession Act. The next slide is on the various initiatives. I won't go through that. I just want to give you an update on mandatory audit firm rotation. There's some background as to how it happened. The effective date is 1 April 2023. But again, the RBA did not sit back after it was approved in June 2017. We have been monitoring the markets, we've been monitoring the firms, we've been monitoring their clients, we've been meeting with the clients, we've been meeting with the banks, other regulators, like the Reserve Bank, to talk about what they believe could be possible challenges when mandatory audit firm rotation becomes effective in 2023. And the reason we gave the lead-in time of 5 years is to prepare the market so that on 1st of April 2023 there are no challenges in implementing mandatory audit firm rotation. Some of the issues that could affect a mandatory audit firm rotation would be, for example, where there's joint audits, or where there's cooling off periods when auditors also perform other services and they can't become the auditor in a period of 5 years. We've proposed, together with the Institute, changes to the Companies Act to make the current cooling off period of 5 years 2 years. So that mandatory audit firm rotation could be implemented much easier. But we are looking at any challenges now so that we can ensure that it works when 2023 comes. The next two slides gives you an update on the status of mandatory audit firm rotation. Although it's only effective on 1st of April 2023, at September 2019, 21% of JSE listed companies had already rotated their audits voluntarily. There's no rule at the moment, but 21% of auditors rotated their companies. When we look at the AGMs, we noted that in the past, where there was sometimes not even a single shareholder voting against the reappointment of an auditor, shareholders voting against the reappointment of the same auditor have gone up to 47%. And I believe that is because the public, investors and stakeholders and shareholders are now aware of the importance of independence, and therefore they are already voting against the reappointment of the same auditor. And our next statistic shows that of those companies that rotated their auditors, 41% have cited mandatory audit firm rotation as the reason. And despite the resistance in the past, the markets have now accepted, moved on, and are preparing themselves for 1st of April 2023. Another big development that we're looking into, I've already talked about the comprehensive regulation, so I won't go through that in detail, other to say that we have made proposals to the minister. The recommendations came from the World Bank, and if we can get support from Parliament to also get the oversight over these other stakeholders in place, then that should address a lot of the issues that we're currently facing in the country. I've talked a little bit about the risks of fragmented regulation. I'm not going to go through those in detail, but clearly it's clear that if we have a system where all those stakeholders are regulated, and if it's regulated by one body, it's even better, so you don't have different bodies with different outcomes and different processes. And at the moment, we don't even have authority amongst regulators in South Africa to share information. And then we still have to look at how we share information with international regulators. Our recent high-profile cases, we've listed a few of them there. The African Bank hearing has been concluded. It's been our biggest hearing. The heads of argument takes place on the 4th and 5th of May, and the findings of the committee will be handed down in June. Sounds like a long process, but and it is. But that's how the Act currently expects us to operate. The Nova investigation is ongoing. Steinhoff investigation is ongoing. We're still waiting for financial statements, so we can't proceed without that. The VBS Bank is at a consent order stage, meaning that we are talking to the auditors to see if they will agree to the charges, and we might not have to go through a disciplinary hearing. And then, of course, Dongaat Ulett investigation is also ongoing, but we are cooperating. We are receiving a lot of cooperation from Dongaat in respect of making information available to the RBA. I won't go into detail into the capacity limitations other to say that what I said earlier, we do not have sufficient funding, we do not have sufficient capacity. Our investigation department currently has 5 investigators. To put that into context, when PwC did the investigation on some of the big high-profile cases, they used a lot more investigators over a much longer period. And we have to use our investigators to get through all these high-profile cases. But we have budgeted for more. The board have approved the appointment of 3 more investigators, and we continuously engage with Treasury to provide us with more money so that we can appoint more, increase our capacity. And Chair, I'll close off by just really closing the loop on KPMG, where we have been to Standing Committee on Finance to say that in terms of addressing the KPMG situation, the RBA has started to monitor more closely KPMG and their initiatives to turn things around at the audit firm. The result was that they present the IRBA and our board with a quarterly report. They've given us a plan. They report against that plan, and that plan covers things like leadership, ethics, their methodology, audit quality, their staff, their leadership, training, culture, and they report quarterly back to us on how they've progressed against these. We continue to monitor those reports, and if we find that there's anything that worries us, we can go back to them. But suffice to say that KPMG has invested a lot in turning things around, and they have been meeting most of their deadlines when it came to the plan that they presented to the board. Thank you, Chair.
Yes,
thank you very much, Chair. I hope you'll also give me 45 minutes because I've got quite a lot to deal with. Mr. Gullis, thank you very much for your presentation. I appreciate it. And also just to mention your reputation precedes you. Congratulations on your fine work of yourself and your organization. I'm not sure if you are making yourself available or if you are eligible to be the new CEO. But if we don't see you after the end of, I think you said March or May, I want to just say thank you for what you've done for the industry and for South Africans. Good. Having got that out of the way, I think I have quite a few questions. So let's get straight into it. I think the Auditor General has already said that having a good audit profession is something that affects investor confidence, something that you've mentioned a lot as well. We are in a really, really difficult position at the moment, and I think you will find that this committee will largely support your initiatives for legislative changes and also for financial assistance as far as can be managed, understanding as well, of course, that appropriations is under tremendous pressure at the moment, but I'm presuming that, unlike Eskom, you're not looking for $250 billion. I did, however, note that you listed your various income streams, and government grants was about $40 million. I'm just wondering, where would you need that to go? Because understanding, and of course, there's a couple of different scenarios at play. Number one is, all things being equal as they are now, Where would you need that to be, the government grant portion of your funding, in order to be more effective? So I'm asking you to put a number to it effectively. In addition to which, in terms of the additional responsibilities that you are looking to take on in terms of extending your mandate into the accounting profession as well as the audit profession, how much more would that require in order to make that effective? Because obviously to change the law is one thing, to change your mandate is one thing, but you need to be empowered to do that as well. So what's the financial impact of that change? I think I've made myself clear. The comments about the right touch regulation also affects the finances, because I think that there was a high degree of self-regulation in the past, and that worked for a long time. Obviously, that environment has changed, and it's now a case where greater regulation, greater external regulation is required. That obviously needs to be funded. But similar to speed traffic offences, where on a stretch of road, if there's consistent bad behaviour, you'll find the cops come and sit for a couple of weeks, they issue a whole lot of speed fines, and all of a sudden people are aware that, hold on, the cops might be here, let's stick to the speed limit, and people tend to stick to the speed limit. That's the way the traffic enforcement works. I presume that your regulation would go through similar cycles. So perhaps additional financing now, or additional funding now, would be effective, but that could also be tapered off at a later stage once there's a higher degree of self-regulation, and getting to more towards that right touch. So do you agree with me that there would be some higher external regulation required on the industry now, and then it could possibly taper off a little bit later? You spoke about 4,300 auditors, and I presume that's individual people, not audit firms, from the numbers that I've seen elsewhere. I'd be interested to know how many audit firms there are, because we're talking about mandatory audit rotation. And the fact that we have these fairly large, the big five, I think it's now big six that people refer to, making audit rotation not the easiest thing, but also affecting the transformation of the industry as well and a whole lot of other issues. So how many audit companies are there? I know that we've got the few big ones that deal, but considering that we've got 375 JSE companies and 49 Altex listed companies, 4,000 auditors actually seems an incredibly low amount, and I'm wondering what the causes of that. Maybe you can enlighten us a little bit more on that. Yeah, there were a lot of notes that I made. Slide 9 was important. Yes. Okay, so let's talk about slide 9, and specifically, you mentioned it again later on in terms of some of the high-profile cases. The amount of time that is being taken to do these investigations and to finalize them, if one looks at slide 9, you'll see that the number of investigations finalized in 2018 and 2019 was substantially lower, like half of what new cases were coming on board. This obviously is going to create a larger and larger backlog, and is going to end up making your organization less and less popular, I think, with the public. Now, of course, I hear what you're saying about some of the high-profile cases being ongoing, waiting for financial statements, etc., etc. But it looks to me like there's a growing backlog, and this is indicating to a big problem and a systemic problem. And I'm wondering if taking on additional responsibilities at this stage is something that can even be thought about when one's considering that you're not even touching sides really with what your current mandate is. And the investigation, for example, into Steinhoff, taking way too long for the public satisfaction. I understand that financial statements are being are delaying the process, but there must be some sort of deadlines. There must be some sort of a timeline that you can give us here. This is a high-profile case, and I think you actually mentioned Tongaat Hulot is cooperating. Tongaat Hulot is cooperating quite strongly, or quite well, and I think we've seen evidence of that in the newspapers as well. The chairman has come out in strong support, etc., etc. Are you getting that same level of support from Steinhoff, from the people that have taken over at Steinhoff and the people that are responsible for turning it around? You know, are you likely to get those financial statements soon, or are they continuing to kind of muddy the waters or fudge the system? I'd like a bit more information on Steinhoff particularly, please. That is the one that we're looking at. Can you tell me a bit, please, about your relationship with SARS? Do you have a degree of cooperation with them? I think that there would probably be a high level of cross benefit and association between the two of you. So do you cooperate with them to any degree? That chair is my bit for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Good morning, members. Chair, the independent regulatory board, I just want to check in terms of consistency, in terms of your public and private sector, in terms of the challenges which are there, and your role in terms of the different sectors. And also, I'm checking in terms of as an oversight, we are doing oversight as from a government, as parliament. In our role in terms of, we want to turn around the situations. If you look in terms of regaining the confidence of public, of the public, in terms of the, specifically on the high profile cases, and I think from a view of oversight, we would want to see a situation of more effective and efficient in terms of turning around those situations, specific on the high-profile cases. So any recommendations from your side as to fulfill our role as an oversight committee of parliament, and also the gaps that you would believe that there are gaps in terms of avoiding going forward situations that we are currently sitting with. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Let me acknowledge the presentation. I've got two questions here. First one there on the slide number 2. Well, you talked about the registration of 4,076 auditors. I just want to check, is it possible maybe to break it down in terms of race and gender? Then question 2, on the slide 33, there's a table there that shows the, what the body is doing in order to restore the confidence in to the auditors. I just want to check with the body, because these auditors, sometimes they are working under abnormal situations, whereby they get threats if they want to report the misconduct. They are tempted to be bribed and so on. So is there anything that the body is doing to protect those auditors so that they don't find themselves falling in, having fallen into a trap like Mr. Vessels ended up being in a trap? Thank you.
Many of the questions I wanted to ask have already been asked by others, especially Dennis. Although what Dennis doesn't know is that I asked the same questions previously. So actually he was asking most of the questions that I asked previously because he wasn't here. But one or two other questions. One is You see, there's a reduction in the number of auditors. Why is that the case? Secondly, how many auditors do you think are needed for a country of South Africa's size and economy? Thirdly, has this meant there is a decline in the proportion of people of color, particularly Africans and colored, in the auditing profession? Then on the mandatory audit rotation, you will recall, Bernard, the majority in the committee, certainly the ANC study group, supported it, but had strong reservations about the process of consultation was our big issue. And we felt it should be deferred, and we got a lot of pressure, not from the big companies. They can't lobby me, the chair of the committee, or anybody outside of my reporting back to the committee. So I never met any of them. Some of them did send like endless emails. We just forwarded it to everybody. So wasn't anything I can recall. But there were public sector stakeholders who also felt that the matter should not be proceeded with then. There wasn't any question that this mandatory audit rotation was a correct thing. Now, they threatened to go to court and do this and that. And we were also concerned about that because we thought it'll get bogged down. But what happened? Was it the usual threat? I say this because we must need to realize that every time the private sector comes in, if they disagree, they threaten to go to the highest court in the land. On most occasions, in my experience, it doesn't happen actually. So what really happened? They were threatened to go to court. Even after we passed the bill, they lobbied certain powerful people in the government and in the political party who also contacted me to say, look, you know, have you guys done the right thing? And when I explain what it is, they say, yes, but you know, that's not the issue. The issue is. So on the progress on disciplinary inquiries, it would be good, Bernard, I've spoken to you about this before, that you are more in the media. The people's patience is not endless. And the frustration around even the Zondo Commission suggests, like I think the Zondo Commission, I can't subscribe to them, need to say something more. I think NPA needs to say something more about progress and why we can't do more and we could lose court cases if we rush them. So the same applies to the IRPA. I really think you should communicate more. I've seen the outcome in the Business Day and elsewhere. But you know, Business Day is read by a certain elite. Really, it should be in Soweto. Really, it should be in community newspapers. Really, you should even put adverts if you can afford it. Oh, yeah, no, you can't afford it, but what I mean is, some of these knock-and-drops will take it free. So in short, you need to communicate more to the public why you cannot act more swiftly. Then a question is perhaps unfair, and I think I know the answers, but you know, I want your response. Why is it that in the last few years, the auditing profession has been so held, to put it mildly? Has it always been the case in previous scrutiny of regulatory bodies like yourself and elsewhere in the world, or is it that you know, capital finds itself in a bigger crisis post-2008 and in its relentless pursuit for profits, all sorts of wrongdoings are occurring. You don't have to be a socialist to say that. You can be a liberal to say that. So it's not like an ideologically driven platitude. The question I'm making, the question I'm putting to you is it related to what's been happening? What is it? Then on the issue, frankly, my view is my personal view. Overregulate, so what? When there are people doing wrong, I don't think you should be, you know, if you have capacity and resources, overregulate them. They have shown themselves to be criminals. Overregulate them. I don't see a problem. Later down the road, once they start behaving, you and government and all can review it in Parliament. Then on the issue of, we used to be regarded very highly in the world ranking bodies. Auditing standards, astonishing, as I kept saying. It's almost funny listing given the amount of corruption we have in this country. Are we still, we were once, I think, in the top three. Once we were first, I think, and so on.
is that the case anymore, given all the number of wrong, given the number of wrongdoing by auditors in the last 2-3 years, or have we retained our ranking? Then on the issue of Poppy's questions, which are on page 8 and 9, Poppy, do you want to ask them? Many of them are answered, but do you want to raise them? No. Okay, Poppy has the shyness, so she's completely out of ever becoming a public representative. You can't hear Poppy? Oh, is that the reason you can't speak? That's fine. She's shy, so I'll read the questions. Most of it you have dealt with, but in fairness to her, she spent some hours doing this, and you know what? We cannot let it pass, because then what's the point? So her questions are, how does the sector recover? In other words, how do you restore confidence? Right? How can companies place reliance on auditors? What assurance can be given to the market and investors? In a way, you've addressed that, but you might want to address explicitly. Why did Uber take so long to flag compliance issues at these big funds? Good point. She's putting it differently from what others are doing. What is being done by Uber to make sure that medium-sized firms, particularly black-owned ones, get access to the market to ensure fairness and to narrow the inequalities between big firms and smaller stroke medium-sized firms? Where were you, Poppy, in the last few years? Mere process was, Antonio was here. Welcome to Antonio. We're going to appropriate her from the Standing Committee on Finance. Stila, she's the researcher from the Standing Committee on Finance. She did a sterling job in the last 5 years. But I think the new chairperson is a very soft guy, so maybe she's not performing so well. Nobody's breathing down her neck like I used to. Not literally, obviously, people get the wrong. Where's the lady now? She might get the wrong impression. Okay, so anyway, has there been any pushback from the industry, she asked? If so, has it mostly been from the big firms, has it mostly been from the big pro-capitalist, profit-seeking, running dogs of monopoly capital? That's what she actually asked, but because it's not appropriate for parliamentary researchers to take such a strong ideological line, I think I'll recast that to read. Mostly from the big firms. For those of you who don't know me and my silliness, of course she never used this word. That's the sort of the Antonio one used. Of course, that's not true either. Okay, what have been some of the reasons for the pushback, she asked very soberly. Does Uber think that the MAFR is enough to strengthen independence and auditing profession? I think that you've answered many times before and certainly today. Does Uber anticipate that there could be unintended consequences as a result of MAFR? Yeah, that's a good one. You may want to answer that specifically. Simplification of jargon. I like this. This is my favorite topic for a man who does make a lot of nonsensical words gush out of me. To ensure that audit reports are accessible to all, there needs to be a simplification of the language used in the report. It will also facilitate greater participation by the public when it comes to the movement of bills, etc. I absolutely agree with you, Poppy. Absolutely agree. I'm a Poppyist, right? This is something I've felt very strongly. Okay? I think Poppyism should be our new philosophy. Of course, Dickelady will see something nefarious in there. Poppy, what is that now? Cocaine, right? Poppy is cocaine. I'm sorry to ask you, you probably think I'm making you vulnerable. Okay, Dennis, as a former hippie, what's Poppy? Poppy is cocaine, or Poppy is something else? You were never a hippie, I can tell. Okay, we leave. It's okay. Nobody wants to answer. It is, eh? Yeah, it's another word for cocaine. So we don't mean non-cocaine poppyism.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the question.
Now we're going to get this right. We are 26 years into democracy. Democracies have been around for 300 years, I would say. Sharing of information among regulators. It's a worldwide problem, right? So when the hell, what can we do about it as a committee? We don't make noise, but you know, we need the NA committee to actually be warned of it. Secondly, may I ask before I forget, the bill, as you can recall, has it been certified at 75 or 76? Okay, because that influences how much we can shape, the ultimate outcome of the financial maximum minimum.
Right? Can you say 75 or 76?
Familiar with those issues? Yeah. Oh, okay, it's fine. We can speak to Frank sometime, yeah.
Thank you for the questions and also for the interest that the committee has taken in our work. It was a start-up, I think, to thank Dennis for the positive feedback and the confidence. I'll start by responding to those questions first, and I'll go through all the members' questions separately. On the government grant, at the moment, as you noted, the formula has always been that we receive one third from government. That 40 million, we believe that if there's any increase in our funding, it doesn't have to increase proportionately amongst the how we split the third amongst the three sources. A figure that I can think of immediately is in our budget for the next year, we have included a figure for 44 million rand just for the disciplinary cases. And when you ask, what is it that we will do with this additional money that we ask, that we request from Treasury, it's mostly to be able to carry out our investigations and our disciplinary hearings. Of course, that would be cheaper going forward. And I'll also tell you what other amendments in the Act will help us. You asked about the number of cases in the backlog, but I'll come back to that. But if I had to give you a figure for now, we have budgeted specifically for the hearings coming up a figure of 44 million addition. I'm not saying that it should come from government, but unless we get it from government, it means that we have to increase auditors' fees, and therefore it can impact on our independence from the auditing profession if we start getting more money from them. The budget for comprehensive regulation, in our proposal to the minister, we've tried to come up with a figure. It wasn't that easy. It wasn't a big figure because the reason what the World Bank recommendations recommend is just that there must be oversight over these stakeholders. It doesn't say that it has to be the IRBA. The proposal to the minister and the reasons for it being the RBA is because we have over 60 years of experience in regulation and oversight, and we know the accounting and auditing industry, and therefore it would be useful, again, not to have two organizations trying to do the same thing, have it under one organization. And the model, I specifically didn't put the model that we proposed on the slides because the minister hadn't approved it yet, but the way we see it is that we will not regulate 50,000 accountants in South Africa. We will regulate 10 professional bodies. And the way that we have oversight over SAICA, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants at the moment, we accredit SAICA, it's the only accredited body. We monitor them, and we have oversight over their members indirectly. We will do the same with the other 10 professional bodies that we have in the country, have oversight over them and ensure that they have processes in place to manage their members. And therefore, we don't see us doubling in size just because we have to increase the oversight over more people. We see ourselves as doing this in a way that we will have oversight over those accountants, but indirectly through their professional bodies. And therefore, it did not amount to a lot of money. I can't think of the figure now, but it wasn't double our budget. We don't require that. We will appoint a few more people that will monitor the 10 professional bodies like we monitor SAICA at the moment. On the right touch regulation, and also taking the chair's comment into account about we must over-regulate if we need to, yes, if we, ideally we should not be spending the kind of money that we do at the moment, budget for 44 million disciplinary hearings, because the profession should improve and get better. And in that situation, I do believe that the money that we require will need to taper off. We can make an adjustment. Hopefully, if government has continues to support us, then it's possible for us to consider making an adjustment to the fees that we charge auditors, because ultimately we don't want to charge auditors any fees because of the independence. But it would mean that there are ways of We're not going to sit with surpluses. We might just be able to charge auditors less. Or maybe government will then reduce their allocation to us. But yes, the budget that we have submitted on the 31st of January takes into account the current situation in the profession. It should be impacted if things get better. The number of auditors, the individuals, our Act says that we regulate audit individuals and audit firms. We have 2,000 audit firms at the moment on our register. So everybody thinks there's only four firms, but actually there are 2,000 firms. They're divided into sole practitioners, small firms, medium-sized firms, and then the big four firms. So when the comment comes back to us to say that it's very difficult to rotate when you only have a few firms, that is not true. There are 2,000 firms in South Africa. We accept that not all of them are at the same level, and not all of them have the competency and the capacity to take up big audit clients. And therefore, we needed to the process that we need to put in place is to ensure that those other firms are capacitated to take on these big clients. So in the UK, for example, they talk about breaking up the big four firms. They say they are too powerful, they have to break them up. That is not our attitude in South Africa, to break them up, but we do want other firms to compete with them. We want other firms to have the capacity to be able to take on these big clients. And in 2017, when we introduced mandatory audit firm rotation, some of the firms came back and said, it's useless to us because we can't do these audits. And we knew that the market would eventually respond, because where there's an opportunity, the audit firms would not sit back and do nothing. And what surprised us a lot is that so many of the small and medium or the next year firms came to talk to us about merging with each other so that they can prepare themselves. We are looking into at the moment how we can allow access of overseas auditors onto our register. At the moment, you have to be South African to be on our register, so that when a firm is connected to an international firm or a global firm, then they can at least get the capacity from overseas. Currently, you can't do that. But we are looking into how we can provide that access so they can build the capacity and take on these audits. And so many firms have come to talk to us about not only mergers, but what they can do to build up their own capacity. So the market have already responded, and I believe that if they continue to respond, then they might be ready to take on these new clients, because they will not want to lose the opportunity. The mandatory audit firm rotation is also, it's not just the auditors, well, the auditors have to comply with it. But it also means that the companies which they audit, especially the listed companies, their audit committees will have to start giving the opportunities and thinking about appointing next year firms. It's not even on their radar at the moment. And the first thing they say is there's only four firms. What must we do? Half of them are providing other services, so they're excluded. There's joint audit, so another firm is excluded. And we're saying to them that they should also start from their side to consider whether they should think at least about these other firms, because the big four firms are in a position to audit big companies because somebody gave them an opportunity at some stage. And at some stage, these big companies and the banks will have to give the opportunities to these other firms. Now, we're not saying be irresponsible and give a huge bank to a small firm. We're saying, why don't you have a system whereby there's already joint audits, but instead of just the normal joint audit where there's two firms coming together, there has to be a better system of transferring those skills to the firm. Maybe let them audit a smaller branch. Start off with that. Help them prepare over time to, first of all, open the door for them and let them get the experience to be able to take on a big bank eventually. Not overnight, but eventually. But there has to be a system and a period over which we try to capacitate them. But first of all, the audit committees must open their minds to appointing these firms. Secondly, we are working very closely with the audit committee forum, explaining to them that it's not just the RBA that must force this. You must also give the opportunities to the others. You must start changing your own mindset. But it also means that we need transformation amongst the audit committees, because they themselves are not sufficiently diverse to consider changing things around. The second forum that we've been engaging with very closely is the CFO forum, because the management of the companies also have a lot of influence in who gets appointed. And yes, they might be reluctant and they might disagree with us, but I think once we start to get them to think about it, at least now, there's some way that they've opened their minds to it at least. On joint audits, the criticism, we can say that get a smaller company to join in a joint audit, but in South Africa, joint audits didn't work. It's never worked, really. For the banks, it's not in their act, but they have joint audits because it's good to have a second pair of eyes. The only place that I'm aware of that joint audits work is in France. It doesn't really work anywhere else. So one of our big projects on our list, the matrix, I think somewhere there we had put that we worked on guidance on joint audits so that we can see how a joint audit can actually be effective. It's not just two companies coming together, the big firm taking most of the money or half of the money by doing most of the work and not transferring skills. We have now issued a guide on joint audits to these firms. And we have the support of the Reserve Bank, because the Reserve Bank also said that if we are going to consider other firms coming into this market, then we have to be sure that there's a way of transferring those skills. So these are it's not overnight solutions. But in the long run, it has to work, and it must help with what we're trying to achieve. But to answer your question, the number of firms, yes, there are actually 2,000 firms registered with us. The number, and I think the chair also asked about what is the right number of firms. We believe that we can't say it should be 6,000 or 4,000 or 3,000, but we believe that the market will respond to the number of auditors that are required. When the Companies Act introduced independent reviews, it now said that you don't need auditors, you can have accountants doing independent reviews, for example. And the market responded by firms doing more independent reviews, but that has now changed again. In fact, there's not many independent reviews, everybody's now going back to audit. If there's a market for auditors in a free market, if there's a market, then somebody will step in and do the audit. So we're never in a position where we believe there are too many auditors in the market or too few auditors. The auditors and the number of auditors we see will respond to the conditions out there. If suddenly there's a requirement to do more audits, we'll find that more people will register with us because there is an opportunity. And we believe that it's market forces that will determine the number, but I cannot give you an exact number. It looks like it's about 4,000 because that's what it's been for the last couple of years. High-profile cases in the backlog, you're absolutely right. If we continue to take on more cases, we are never going to get past our backlog. But again, one of the big amendments in the Auditing Profession Act amendments, and thank you also for saying that you'll support those amendments, one of the big changes is that we want the ability to request the Institute or any professional body to take on our non-public interest investigations, because the numbers that we've reported to you includes not only high-profile cases, but also non-public interest cases. And therefore, if we can transfer those cases to the Institute and make sure that they do a proper job of those investigations, then we don't have to do it. And if the Act amendments go through, then we will only be left with a few high-profile cases, and then we should not build up a backlog. We're trying to get rid of the backlog by moving it to the Institute. That is a very important amendment in our legislation. Yes, if we trying to get to our current workload, it might not be a good idea to take on additional responsibilities right now, but with the proposals to the minister, there was a proposal for more capacity, and as I mentioned, it doesn't have to be double the size of what the RBA currently is. It would just be a few more people that can do the monitoring for us. And we won't be able to do it with our current capacity. On the Steinhoff investigation, I'll say that we have reported in Parliament that initially we did have a lot of challenges to get hold of the information. It remains a challenge without the financial statements for 2016 and 2017. We can actually not do an investigation if we don't have that. But the information that we've requested, we have started to work much more closely with the new management and specifically the chairman, and more contact with them the opportunity to be able to reach out to them if we are having issues, and we did have issues in the beginning. We could not get hold of the information, but we have worked on a process to engage much more closely, not with the lawyers, but with the management, and specifically the chairman, and they have, things have changed. We are getting more cooperation from them, provided they make available to us the financial statements. So that while that is outstanding, it still hampers us, but the cooperation is a lot better than it was before. SARS, I was trying to think whether we have an MOU with SARS specifically. The only engagement we have with SARS at the moment is that when there's a reportable irregularity, there's a lot of reportable irregularities that involves non-compliance with tax, we send that to SARS, and SARS actually reports back to us to tell us what they do. A formal arrangement where we work more closely with SARS, we don't have in place, and it's a very good idea that we probably consider that. Again, when I talked about fragmented regulation, everybody's doing their own thing, but we're not sharing information. And our legislation, unfortunately, at the moment, doesn't allow for that. I think if the legislation is changed in all the regulators, so it doesn't help if RBA's legislation changed, but SARS's legislation doesn't change.
Do this, right? Let's move. Can you? We are requesting it. You're not interfering in the legislative process. You know, people might get that. This is Parliament. Is there any objection to this? Can you, within 10 days, give us a proposal on what acts need to be changed? What should be done? First, just set out, maybe 10 days is a bit, because you need some sort of work. Okay, within 14 days, or as reasonably soon thereafter, can you give us a two-pager on what needs to be done? Secondly, can it be done in the current act? I'm in the current act, the current bill, before whoever is processing it through Parliament. Okay, make a proposal. But remember, that's what's important with 75. We need to persuade the SCOF committee. Antonia, are you awake? Yeah, there's Antonia here. She happens to be here. Fine. Let's try to put it in the current bill. I will speak with Joe, the chairperson of that side, and we'll speak to the DDG concerned, right?
Chairman,
I'll phone him this evening, yeah.
Chairman, it won't delay the current bill.
Yeah, you see, there's a difficult thing. Suddenly, as I'm speaking, they will say, but you see, if it's a consequential amendment, yes. But if not, when you say the bill is where it is, has it been published in the public domain for comment already in the Gazette?
Minister issued a Gazette on Monday.
Or for public comment?
It just says that it will be tabled in National Assembly.
It doesn't
say anything about comment.
It will probably come to us fairly soon. Good. Let's leave this to me. I will speak to the person concerned, whom you know, and then in the meanwhile, you will send within 14 days or reasonably soon thereafter a motivation and a proposal for amendment. Actually, if you can give us the clause, the wording, you've got lawyers in your right. That's so much the better.
I'll work with National Treasury as well, Chair.
Anybody okay?
Okay, Chair, the next question was on how the committee can support us on the high-profile cases, and I've already responded by saying that if we can move those to SAICA, it would help us tremendously, but that can only happen if the Auditing Profession Act amendments are approved, because the amendments include those changes. The committee can help us to obtain more funding, certainly. The committee has always been aware of it and tried us. I'm talking about SCOF. But I think if this committee also wants to support us, they can do it in respect of getting more funding. And also to support comprehensive regulation, because we feel that if we only regulate a part of this chain, it's not useful if the others aren't regulated. So any support for proposals on comprehensive regulation will really go a long way. We'll send the committee the breakdown of the race and gender of RAs. We do have it. I'll send that to the today. Okay, sorry. So thank you, Marius. Has already gotten the information. I'll just read it to you. As of today, there are 3,890 RAs, so it's gone below the 4,000 number. African, 7%. Chinese, 0.2%. Coloured, 1.2%. Indian, 7.4%. White, 79%.
Have we got the race?
We'll send the race unless we can get it now. The gender, sorry. So not the race, the gender. We'll send the gender. Auditors, how do auditors get?
What we said to you, this is appalling, really. Appalling, like in this day and age. There was an exponential growth of African auditors for a while. Colors are also underrepresented, right? Whites and Indians, whites in particular, also Indians overrepresented. Same old story, right? Of course, this goes beyond your mandate. But the committee needs to do something about this. So, you know, we need to put pressure. And when the bill comes, I think we must see what can be done. Because this is not acceptable, really. Not 26 years beyond the democracy. But I don't know what to do. I will think about it. Members can think about it. But we have to be incrementally, over time, we can't create auditors from the sky. But on the other hand, this is completely unacceptable. Appalling. Is there any role you can play, or Irma just cannot?
Chair, our education department is actually called the Education and Transformation Department, and you'll recall that one of our four pillars had been transformation. So we have a list of projects to see how we can attract, and there's a lot of projects behind this that where we go out and we socialize the concept of auditing amongst black students. We do that. With the audit development program, in the past, the training was managed by the institute, not by the RBA. The ADP now puts us in direct contact with the firms and the students, and we engage and try and get more black students onto the ADP program. I can't give you statistics right now, but we do have an influence and we do have projects to try and increase the number of black RAs. But that, of course, is dependent on the pipeline from the institute. So the number of CAs determine the number of black RAs. And we work closely with the institute to see. They have a lot of transformation initiatives, and that will obviously feed through to the RAs.
So you can't afford that?
We can't.
Because, I mean, going there and popularizing it is one thing. Making people aware of the potential and prospects in this area is another thing. But getting people, and it helps, getting people to actually, you know, get the wherewithal to study and so on, the funding and, you know, the, I don't know, like professional mentorship or whatever is important. And, okay, let me ask you, you don't have to answer this question if you feel it's not appropriate. How do you think this government and parliament and whoever else, whichever other stakeholder, can help in this regard to make it more representative? Before you answer, Fani had his hand up and tell us.
Chair, thank you. I think if the gentleman can first answer, then I can put my question afterwards. I'd appreciate that.
Chair, I'm not sure that your question has been answered already, and I think that this committee has the powers of subpoena, and perhaps we need to ask the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants to come and present to us and tell us what they're doing, and we can then investigate, because I think it's quite clear that there's a building block required. Before you become an auditor, you need to become a chartered accountant. So perhaps we can interrogate those numbers first, get feedback from them before we're putting unnecessary pressure on this board.
Presumably Bernard's used to me. I said, if you think it's appropriate, you can reply. I said, it's beyond your mandate. It's not fair on you. But do you want to answer? So you're under no pressure to answer. Right. Are you feeling very nervous? Are you feeling very pressured? Do you need protection from Dennis? From me? Oh, please.
I need protection.
You're fine with this thing, Dennis. What can we do, right? I mean, really, this is unacceptable. Right, I think all of us agree, hopefully. But we realize, Bernard, we're not naive. We're not like populists, you know, that you can do it overnight. But what can we do? That's all we say. You ask, you know, the question is not put to you so much as a CEO of Irma, but also the individual who knows the terrain and the area. And you don't have to answer.
Chair, I think the suggestion about the pipeline is a very good suggestion, and I'd also maybe like to I'd like to come back to the committee and give you some of our ideas of what we think, not what we're doing, but how the committee can help us, because we always think about what we can do with our limited mandate, but if the committee can support us, give us an opportunity to think about that.
I'm staged. I'll be noting this in a minute. But what we will do, Dennis, your idea about bringing... Can I get some clarity, Bernard? The Chartered Accountants Association is not a statutory body, is it? They're not accountable to Parliament, if I remember.
No.
Yeah. But they have been very cooperative. In fact, they appeared before our committee last year, or the year before, I can't recall. And their previous chairperson is now caught up in the... Well, the previous senior... So I think it's a good idea, Dennis. It's on our agenda. We'll try to slot it in the second quarter.
Thank you, Chair. Yes. Thank you for giving me an opportunity. Notice the figures, and I've noticed that a few people's eyes started to flicker in the seats here. I'm only concerned that if one pushes something too much, the end result might not be what you want. We must remember, at the moment, the biggest problem that South Africa is currently in is financial. That's part of the big problem. If we look at what the BEE legislation has brought forth up to now, with people being placed in different positions and not necessarily need to be there or must be there due to qualification, current employment, all of that, one must be very, one must tread lightly when you want to push something to happen. I mean, becoming a chartered accountant, that doesn't happen overnight. I believe that the current education system has evolved tremendously. A lot of people are currently getting opportunities that they didn't necessarily have before with regards to free education, access to tertiary education, all of that, employment in different companies. So one must just make sure not to push out people that are currently there in that market doing a decent job and making space for another person that doesn't necessarily get there on the basis of merit. And by saying that, I'm not saying that people of other races than white are not qualified to do that. I'm just saying we must see to it that people get education and people get equal opportunities to perform the work and the tasks that they need to do for the benefit of the country. Forcing something always results in problems.
Thank you, Chair. I just want, my first response would be that there should never be any concern that the standards would drop. It should always, everybody would have to comply with the same standards. And because there's no limit, it's not a profession where we can only limit it to so many. We will never substitute one race for another. It won't be necessary. And therefore, our initiatives will always, for transformation, will focus on getting more black people into the profession, but not at the expense of the people that are there and that are doing a good job. We still need them. So it's not the one or the other. It will always be in addition.
You know, basically, may I repeat, Fani and whoever wants to hear, I use the word populist. We're not populist. I said the people won't fall from the skies. There's no suggestion that it's a deployment. There's no ability for government to deploy people who are not qualified to be auditors, to be auditors in the private sector. I mean, the private sector will just treat us with contempt, right? So we can't even do what you're saying. So there's no suggestion of that. What we are saying as a majority, and obviously you don't have to agree, is that this is not an acceptable situation. It only leads to more and more racial polarization. And while the people that take to the streets in the townships and rural areas are ordinary people, a major area of contestation and polarization is around elites, African elites in particular, feeling that they are not given space and that they are now fed up. And this is what drives the racial polarization, is the failure of others to accept that and difficulty over the years to come, I think, in finding a middle ground. We're celebrating Nelson Mandela's heritage today. But how much does it apply today across the racial barriers? Everybody nods to him, from the far right to the far left even, right? Or the, from the far left and the far right even, I mean to say. But where's the middle ground? So we are fast losing that, and, you know, each of us can, and our parties can decide how we think we should deal with the major challenges we face in this regard. But certainly, this situation is untenable, in my view, and the view, I'm sure, of the ANC, and I think the majority of the people here.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks. The question around the what are we doing to ensure that auditors don't feel trapped or get pushed into a situation where they are compromised is this focus on independence? When auditors find themselves in compromising situations, it's because they are not sufficiently independent, they are not sufficiently skeptical. And because we identify that as a root cause, again, we can't stop anybody from an individual person from behaving in a certain way. It's very difficult. What we can do is to strengthen the guidance to them. Certainly, what has happened in the last 2 years has raised the awareness around auditors not being independent. And so auditors are more, and audit firms have put in place more requirements on their own partners to be more independent. They've increased their own rules for independence. For example, our code talks about investments in clients. They probably, if the code says, for example, that you can only have so much percentage, the firms are now saying you can have no investment in your clients, even if it's a small part of a big bank. So the firms have certainly strengthened that. And from the RBA side, one of the things that we did again in our initiatives to address the current issues is to strengthen our own code of ethics. And in our code of ethics, we are giving auditors a lot more guidance to strengthen their independence. And to come back to mandatory audit firm rotation, if we cut off after 10 years, it becomes very difficult for that relationship to build up with that client if they've been there for longer than 10 years, because not only are they limited by 10 years, but also they don't want to do anything wrong that the next firm will pick up on when they step in. So it might not be direct solutions, but indirectly we are trying to, through our code of ethics, raise the awareness and put in place more measures to strengthen the auditor's independence. We talked about the reduction in auditors, how many needed. I'm not sure, Chair, if there's a decline in the numbers of African and coloureds. We have to compare to the previous year. I've just given you the stats as of today. Maurice has also just found out that the gender classification is that we have 75% males and 25% females. Again, I'm sure that you are not happy with that either, and neither are we. You also asked about the court applications after mandatory audit firm rotation. Yes, there has been one small group of auditors that have put in an application to court to stop mandatory audit firm rotation. We are in the process of dealing with it. Fortunately, it is just one group of auditors. We are very pleased that the most of the market, the audit firms and the clients, have accepted, as far as we can see, mandatory audit firm rotation. So other than the one small group, most of them have now started to implement, and as I mentioned, even in advance, mandatory audit firm rotation. I agree that we should talk more about what we do in the media, and I hear what you're saying. It doesn't mean that we are talking about an investigation when we're busy with it. We can't talk about it when we're busy with it, but we can talk about progress and what we have done and what we have completed. I'll certainly take that back and improve on that.
Maybe you can't do what I'm proposing, right? Maybe it's not doable. But it's not like a bland two-line sentence. You know, you have seven cases and so on. It's something more like that reaches out to ordinary people to communicate.
that we're aware of your frustration. We're trying to do the best we can. We're attending to the cases, and we will deal with them, but in a way that doesn't prejudice the outcome of your decisions and subjects them to contestation in a court of law, that you went out prematurely and advertised these things. Obviously, we don't want that. That's stupid, right? But there are ways that you can communicate. I don't know how you do it in a more popular fashion, not the sort of technocratic, if you like, way you communicate in here. Why, my friend? Because this is where we are. This is not Switzerland, okay, as you know. We've got huge crises here, right? I see there's a thing tomorrow called, what is it? The 2020 is the year of orange overalls. There's a whole gathering here in Johannesburg tomorrow, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with a member of parliament being there. It's civil society. We are meant to be there. Many of us have taken part in marches. But orange overalls program is a reflection. They may not have many people there, but they are quite powerful NGOs, civil society, who feel that not enough is being done. This applies as much to auditors as those appearing before the Zondo Commission, the Nugent Commission, and wherever else. So all I'm saying is that, Bennett, I don't know what's appropriate, but we need to get real here. We're not technocrats, all of us. We are, you play a role, but all of us will get swept, including your institution, aside, once the masses reach a threshold level. We know it all over the world. We know it all over, not just in the developed world, right? What happened in France and so on, 17th century. What I'm saying basically is, without undermining your autonomy, independence, professionalism, and all that, and ethical issues, we need to reach out to people. That's all I'm saying. When SARS appears, I'm going to raise it with SARS as well. There's a feeling lots of money is disappearing. And, you know, you need to advertise more what you're doing about it. There ain't any money right now. So, hey, you people can all be technocrats if you want. And Parliament needs to wake up and have more communication directly. And NCOPP need to have more direct contact with the people. So what I'm saying, my friend, is I don't know. We need a new bureaucrat of a type. Not the professional British civil service. Not here. There's not Britain. They are bigger crises in some ways. But that's another story. Right? All I'm saying is, I think all of us, you, Parliament, government, civil society, need to wake up about what professionals in the public sector need to do to bridge the gap between all of us and the people out there.
Thank you, Chair. And it's not a question of us not being able to do it. We can do it. We can do what you're asking and not overstep what we should be doing. So thank you for the suggestion, Chair. The question on the reasons for why we find ourselves in this situation, it's not only auditors' competence that will result in a high-quality audit. It is also auditors' behavior. And I've said in many public platforms that I believe it comes back to our auditors' behavior, which is something that's slightly more difficult to write regulations for, but we are trying. But it comes back to the basics of ethics, basics, and I know everybody is tired of hearing this word, independence. If we can strengthen independence and having stronger legislation. If we have stronger legislation going forward, then we will certainly hopefully address the current situation. What we also find is that the audit firms, we fully appreciate that they are businesses. They have to run businesses. But it's important that the firms and the partners balance their commercialism and their commercial interests with their professional interests. Because you don't focus on the commercial aspect of your business so much that you don't behave ethically, because then you will lose business. But if you are seen as a firm that behaves ethically and does the right thing, you will gain business. And therefore, commercialism must always follow professionalism. The moment I think the balance is a little bit out of kilter. I noted the Chair's comment on over-regulation not being a concern, and we will... Just a view, and I appreciate that. And then on the World Economic Forum ranking, we slipped from number one to a much lower number. We have to continue to work on it. We're not just sitting back.
Are you afraid to? You sound like my son when he was 5 years old. He'll never give you the score. Hey, Mickey,
what is the score? Oh, if he wins, it comes out immediately. If he loses, well, it's Sade. Ah, Dad, you know, in the second minute, as if he knows what the second minute, I gave a lovely pass, and Kelezo hit it against the crossbar, and then, you know, and so on. As Mickey, what's the score? You extracted for 5 minutes later, well, we lost 5-1. So this is Bernard now. Bernard, Mickeyism.
Jay, as long as you don't overreact. It is 31.
How many years?
1 year to get from number 1 to number 31.
Oh, man. And they does not ever...
Out of 50, it's about out of 50 countries.
Oh, man. Bernard, don't ever talk about over-regulating, right? You're
sorry,
bad.
100 something.
But Bernard, whatever it is, it's 30 places down, right? So it's not a reflection on you, obviously, and your team, and Herber, but actually, it's really bad, right? And frankly, fortunately, Linda's not here, so it won't appear, hopefully. What I'm saying in short is, it is bad, and don't come here and talk about over-regulation. Let's regulate as much as we have, and let's act. But I think we need to raise this to put Badger National. There's no money. I mean, all of us will say you need more money, and we agree that you should extend your role. But Bennett, that climate, you know it as well. That climate for even 0.5 cent more out of Treasury at the moment is impossible. The prospects of world socialist revolution are greater, quite frankly, than getting 0.5 cent out of Treasury these days. So here we are, we're in a severe climate. But you are very productive. You have a strong case. So I will also lobby outside the formal terrain. Not that I'll necessarily get. And we need to speak to our sister, the judge, Tikaleri. She needs to speak to Sipisa Butulesi.
Thank you, Jay. To get to Poppy's question, how does the sector recover? I hope that I have dealt with most of those initiatives. Thank you for those questions. I think they were really probably, well, they were well researched because they clearly comes from having done a lot of reading. How will the sector recover if the slide that we have with the 40 initiatives, I do believe that if the audit firms and the RBA work together to deliver on those initiatives, we will get through this. We have to get through it. There's simply no choice. So I believe that if everybody is committed to deliver on those and the firms are supportive, continue to be supportive of our initiatives, then we must get through this negative situation that we find ourselves in. Why has it taken so long to flag these issues? I don't actually think that we were not aware of these issues. When we think about mandatory audit firm rotation, for example, it's not something that came up in 2017. It's something that we started work on in, say, 2014, when we realized that there's an independence issue. It just takes much longer to, and the processes and the resistance and the buy-in and the political support for it. It's not easy to get these things through. The Amendments to our Act, we've recognized that this was needed many years back. But again, although this has been progressed quite fast, it's still something that has taken us, we had to go through the normal processes to get here. So I don't think we were unaware of it and it just struck us overnight. We were aware of it and we've been trying within our limitations to do what we can. But obviously there's a lot more that we must do to prevent this from happening going forward. Access to the markets, mandatory audit firm rotation is meant to address that. The joint audit is meant to address that. And as I mentioned, our continued engagement with the audit committee forums and the CFO forum to ensure that they also, that we socialize the ideas with them and that they start supporting us in opening the access. The pushback was there, certainly, and as I mentioned, some have even taken us to court. But really, from where I'm sitting, the companies and the audit firms have started to implement already, and that's very useful. Mandatory audit firm rotation might not be enough. I think we need more. We probably need to do more, but certainly this has been a good start, and we'll continue to look at more initiatives to improve independence. Jargon.
apologize for that. We'll try and put things in more simple terms. And then sharing of information amongst regulators, we have now a mandate to go and do some research and come back to the committee. That would be very important because, again, even in our Act, we can't share with overseas regulators at the moment without the permission of the auditor. And overseas regulators have said that they will not accept that. To be able to share information, we need to do it as the IRBA, and therefore we're also looking at those kind of amendments. Chair, I think I've answered all the questions. I don't know if there's any more.
Colleagues, we're going to have them back because in the bills here, presumably you will be here for part of it, right? We're dealing with your section. And we need to call Saika back in the second quarter, and then we can call you back as well. So there's plenty, it's an ongoing thing. So I would suggest, unless it's something desperate, we move on to the program. Yes?
Yeah, no, Chair, just wanted to confirm the support from the ANC side that is specifically on the amendment. Amendment because of really giving also the independent board more teeth in terms of the willing, like the issue that we are dealing with now, to say that on the land issue, the willing buyer, willing seller, we are changing to expropriation without compensation, to say that you it's an issue of must in terms of giving that information that is needed so that the board have more power in terms of the specifically on the improvements, yeah, around the inclusion of research and the powers to subpoena and all those things. I think they're fully supporting that.
Thank you, Mr. Njama.
Can we say thank you to you and then move on to the next item, the program. So colleagues, as you know, the first and fourth quarters, it's very hard for innovation in the program because the law prescribes, the Money Bills Act prescribes the processes. So, you know, you don't have much of a latitude, quarter one and quarter four. So you have before you what you have, and if you look at where we are, we've just dealt with IRBA. The next Tuesday, we are meeting with the Reserve Bank. As I understand it, the topic should read the quarterly financial, economic performance and outlook. Yeah, it is a quarterly report, and the current governor has rightly pointed out that that's a very important document, and they don't often get asked to present it to Parliament. That's because of the huge legislative load we had in the fifth term. Now we've got a bit more time because the bills are coming now with the first one that Bernard referred to. So, and then we get the tax bill. So that's really not quite the topic, but it's fine. Then, you know, the Tuesday after that, obviously, then we're going to do nothing. That's the cycle with the other committee. But Mr. Advocate Tao phoned me and raised this matter, and the staff is meeting this afternoon, and we can meet as a multi-party forum next week. The staff meeting is a technical thing. Change this, change that. It's not going to be long. But we will meet next week as the leaders of the political parties here to discuss program further and some of the issues around management of the program and whatever else members from other parties want to raise. We'll have that next week. But this afternoon I'm meeting with them to just finally fine-tune things. But the one thing I wanted to say was that we have to have the land bank here. But before we do, according to Advocate Tao, before he disappears, Advocate Tao, you pointed out that on the 6th of March, the provincial SOPAs are occurring, right? And we are required to be here to deal with the state of provincial addresses. Now, I know that our provinces require us to be there for the state of provincial addresses. Is that the point you were making? And several provinces, is it all are having it on the same day? Advocate, is it several provinces?
About five, but...
We'll have to confer with the National Assembly. Either we don't attend, those who can't, or we have that on the Thursday, the 5th of March. Is that okay? We negotiate. Sorry, yes, Advocate Ta?
Yeah, the team that is supporting the NA committees is proposing another date that will allow this committee...
Yes, yes. As soon as they lobby their political principles.
So can we leave that to you and Nkululeko to deal with?
That's correct.
Okay. Then the next issue, I did report that we spoke this morning about the Z list and that you're attending to the matter even though it doesn't fall under your cluster, right? Yeah, okay, thank you for that. You can go, thank you. Then the next issue is we need to slot in on the 10th of March because we don't need the whole day or somewhere before the end of the first quarter of the land bank. So what date can we fit that in? Yeah, that's right. So the 10th of March we'll start in the land bank, right? Then taking Parliament to the people and those sort of matters that affect the Ethiopian role, and they won't approve of our seeking exemption except the Finance and Appropriations Committees in exceptional circumstances. So we have to do all of that. So this program is really little to discuss, colleagues. Because the next, the second day of the week is always, the parliamentary week is always with the Appropriations Committee, because it's the same committee. So I would ask if people are okay in principle with this program. There's nothing much we can do, unfortunately, yeah. Fani says yes.
Yeah, Chair, I don't see that there's much help from the movement, yeah.